What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
We're the first country to administer 150 million shots and the first country to fully vaccinate over 62 million people. But here's the deal. I promise an update to the American people every 50 millionth shot. And I'm already back to update you a little over two and a half weeks later. I promised in the beginning that I'd always give you the straight scoop, straight from the shoulder, the good and the bad. Well, here's the truth. The good news is we're on track to beat our goal of 200 million shots in the first 100 days. More than 75% of the people over the age of 65 have gotten shots, up from 8% when we took office. That's a dramatic turnaround and critical because seniors account for 80% of all COVID deaths. To help support my goal of safely reopening the majority of K through 8 schools by my 100th day in office, I directed states in early March to make educators and children, child care workers, eligible for vaccines and to get a goal of getting all who wanted the vaccination to be able to have one and to do it in the month of March. I'm pleased to report, according to CDC estimates, over 80% of teachers, school staff, and child care workers received at least one shot by the end of March. And that's great progress protecting our educators, our essential workers. And because our vaccine program is in overdrive, we're making it easier to get a vaccination shot.
And the president is using federal funds to create new community vaccination centers across the country, also launching mobile vaccination programs. And the Department of Health and Human Services has launched a national vaccine promotional campaign. But the president was asked about that as he concluded his remarks earlier today at the White House.
Why the White House hasn't used a more forceful campaign, like advertisement on television, for example, to convince Americans to take that vaccine so
we can move ahead? We are doing that. And by the way, the number of people who are reluctant to take it continues to diminish across the country as they see their neighbors, particularly in communities that have been very — now, there's a different group of people. There's a group of people who have been reluctant because of past — how can I say it? Past wrongs that have been done to them, experimentation, not sure that they're being told the truth, et cetera. But then there's another group. It seems to me to be I probably shouldn't characterize it, but Mitch McConnell keeps speaking to them, which I give him credit for, saying the idea, he said the polling data shows Republican men, particularly young men, don't think they should have to take the vaccine. It's their patriotic right not to do it, their freedom to choose. And he's saying, no, no, take the vaccine. Take the vaccine. And I'll add a phrase he didn't, but I think he believes. It's a patriotic responsibility you have.
And that from the president earlier today. Another issue which has come up in recent weeks and a subject of many of your calls on The Washington Journal, the idea of a vaccine passport, which would allow you to go to public events like baseball games, tournaments, or even a restaurant. Earlier today, though, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki ruling out that the administration would play any role in that concept. More from today's briefing.
One on vaccine again. Is there any thought being given to a federally organized vaccine passport of some kind? Does the president see that maybe as some kind of tool that could be used, or would he lean more on the side of people who have raised objections over privacy and so on?
Well, let me be very clear on this. I know there's been lots of questions. The government is not now, nor will we be supporting a system that requires Americans to carry a credential. There will be no federal vaccinations database and no federal mandate requiring everyone to obtain a single vaccination credential. As these tools are being considered by the private and nonprofit sectors, our interest is very simple from the federal government, which is Americans' privacy and rights should be protected and so that these systems are not used against people unfairly. There is a movement, as you know, in the private sector to identify ways that they can return to events where there are large swaths of people safely in soccer stadiums or theaters. And that's something that that's where the idea originated, and we expect that's where it will be concluded. We will be providing some guidance, which will look like an FAQ, a frequently asked question. I hate acronyms, but that provides important answers to questions that Americans have, in particular around concerns about privacy, security, or discrimination soon. I don't have an exact date for that yet.
Those comments earlier today by White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki, and it was during an interview on KTLO Radio in Mountain Home, Arkansas, that Senator John Bozeman talked about his own campaign to urge his constituents and all Americans to get a vaccine.
I think getting vaccinated is the quickest way back to normal, which we all desperately want. And so just encouraging people, you know, some people don't want to go that route, and that's fine. That's their decision. But for those that do, we want to make sure that they're accessible. And so we've been to big clinics, little clinics, making sure that, all of the different routes are working, that they're getting the vaccines that they need, and then also that people are able to make it easy for them to get in and get vaccinated if they'd like.
And Arkansas is doing a pretty good job.
They're doing a very, very good job.
It's really dropping.
It's dropping, and with the governor's saying that now we're at the point where anyone can show up, you know, and get vaccinated. That's a good thing, because some people were concerned maybe they were taking somebody else's place or, you know, didn't understand. So we've eliminated that burden, and I think we'll have a real surge in the next, a surge in a positive way in the next few weeks.
And your legislation to expand VA vaccine eligibility to all vets in the recent passage, that was good.
Well, it was good, and that really came from Arkansas. Some veterans were concerned. They went in to get vaccinated and wanted their wives vaccinated, which makes sense, you know, if they are, and they couldn't do it. And so at a hearing, we were visiting with the head of the VA Health, and I asked him about it, and he said, that's correct, you know, that they couldn't. And I asked him, you know, if that was, you know, something we could get fixed, and he said, yeah, it needs to be fixed. So I turned to the chairman of the committee, Senator Tester from Montana, and said, we need to fix this. And so we got a bill together, and a couple weeks later it was passed. And what it does is essentially open up the ability of the VA to give vaccinations to everyone, which is great.
And people do work together in Washington sometimes, don't they?
They do. You know, you hear about the bad stuff.
You always remind me of that.
But, you know, there are a lot of good things that go on, particularly in regard to veterans. That's certainly not a partisan issue. You know, that's not about Republicans or Democrats. That's just trying to take care of people that served and always remembering that these are earned benefits. These aren't give-me's.
The full interview with Senator Bozeman, it's available on the KTLO website, a country music station in Arkansas. Now, while millions of Americans have expressed concern about another new wave of COVID-19 infections, the top infectious disease doctor, Anthony Fauci, saying he believes those fears may be overblown, saying that as long as the country continues its mass vaccination efforts and ramping up the vaccine program, the country should be able to avoid another big increase in COVID-19 cases. Now, some doctors and public health experts have been warning that we could see a fourth major wave of new infections. During an interview this morning on MSNBC's Morning Joe program, Dr. Fauci downplaying the recent decline of Texas coronavirus cases nearly a month after the state rescinded its mask mandate, but he did say it could be premature.
You mentioned Texas and that full ballpark in Arlington yesterday. There was a lot of concern last month when Texas effectively opened up, dropped all those restrictions and said it's back to life. And if you go to Texas, as you know, it looks like 2019. The restaurants and the bars are full and open. The ballparks are full. And yet we've seen cases and hospitalizations since then continue to tick downward. So what do you make of that as all of us look around and sort of try to consider how safe it is to get back to normal life?
Yeah, you know, it can be confusing because you may see a lag and a delay, because often you have to wait a few weeks before you see the effect of what you're doing right now. You know, there are a lot of things that go into that. I mean, when you say that they've had a lot of activity on the outside, like ball games, I'm not really quite sure. It could be they're doing things outdoors. You know, it's very difficult to just one-on-one compare that. You just have to see in the long range. I hope they continue to tick down. If they do, that would be great. But there's always the concern when you pull back on methods, particularly things like indoor dining and bars that are crowded, you can see a delay and then all of a sudden tick right back up. We've been fooled before by situations where people begin to open up, nothing happens, and then all of a sudden, several weeks later, things start exploding on you. So we got to be careful. We don't prematurely judge that.
Dr. Anthony Fauci made his comments earlier today on MSNBC, and one of the looming questions, what will the economy look like during the recovery? One of those answers available at Axios.com. This is the headline, 1 in 4 plan to bolt job post-pandemic. With more on that story, Kim Hart, a national technology correspondent for Axios. A study by Prudential, what does it tell you?
It had some pretty striking figures. It was saying 26% of employees are planning to look for a different job at a different company once the pandemic has subsided. And that number is actually even higher for millennials. So 34% of millennials, which is the largest generation in the workforce today, are planning on looking for a new job after the pandemic eases up and the economy starts to really reopen again.
Can you explain the study and, more importantly, its significance?
Sure. So Prudential has been doing this Pulse of the American Worker survey for some time now, and they've been really drilling down on what workers care about, what they value, and how they're being impacted by remote work since the pandemic started. And one of the things that they pinpointed about a year ago when I talked to them about one of their earlier studies was the importance of culture and making sure that employees stay connected to their employers during this remote time when they're not getting FaceTime, they're not seeing their colleagues, they're not getting those one-off meetings in the hallways and things like that that helps to boost your job security and feelings of belonging at a company. And one of the things that Rob Falzon, the vice chair of Prudential, told me about this survey and the takeaway is that culture decay is real. People are no longer feeling connected to their companies. They're no longer feeling like they have a lot of job security there. For example, of those planning to leave their current job, 80% say they're concerned about career growth in their current job, and nearly 75% said the pandemic made them rethink their skill sets and maybe that they need to get more training or do something different as a result of the all-remote environment. So it's really forcing employers to rethink how they're trying to retain these employees. And I think the biggest thing that that the Prudential study pointed out is that these are often the highest performing employees that are looking to jump ship. Those are the hardest for big companies to replace in a high-skilled and working environment that the U.S. has right now. So this is going to be a big challenge for companies as they come out of the pandemic and realize, oh, wait, I have a lot of talent flight to worry about. How am I going to keep these people happy working for me?
And one of the common threads, Kim Hart, in your piece is the concept that is now so common, working remotely, working from home. How significant has the change been for American workers?
This is likely a permanent change, Steve. 90% of the Prudential employees that Prudential studied separately. So 92% of the 7,000 people that they surveyed in an internal survey said that they want to work remotely at least one or more days a week. And that is consistent across a lot of surveys that we're starting to see coming out of companies that are looking at this very topic across the country. So people are so used to working remotely, even though it felt so jarring to so many of us a year ago, now it's what people want. And it's kind of part of the benefits package that people want. But there's a downside to that for employers, which means that because people want to work remotely, they're no longer tied geographically to companies that they can actually be in the office every day. They no longer have to make sure they're within an hour commuting time of a company. That means they have more options. They can work for a company in a different city or that's across the country as long as remote work remains at least part of the norm, or we're moving into a hybrid situation where you don't have to be at the office all the time, even if you you're there maybe once a month or once a week. That could be doable if you don't live in the same city. So employees are having a lot more options, and employers are going to have to really step up their game to make sure that they're retaining the people that are most valuable to their businesses.
So in the category of what to watch, available at Axios.com, how does this affect the rebuilding of the COVID-19 economy for businesses, for large corporations, and for small employers?
Well, some of it has to do with actual office space. How are they going to allocate their resources and decide where they're going to spend their money? Is it going to have to be spent on higher salaries to try to keep some of their employees that they feel are big flight risks versus office space and using that money for commercial real estate rents? Some of this is going to have to be looked at, like the corporate ladder and their pipeline. Women have taken a really big hit in this pandemic. One in four women have thought about leaving their jobs during the pandemic or have done so. A lot of the job loss have fallen on women. And with the child care situation and other responsibilities at home, women are less likely to return to the office, at least initially full time. And in a lot of corporate cultures, that means that men may have the upper hand. They may be, you know, the ones who get the more exciting job opportunities, the more exciting projects, the bigger raises. And so one of the things that I talked to a lot of experts about was specifically the gender gap. And as we rebuild, companies need to make sure that they are providing opportunities for a wide variety of experiences and situations so people of all kinds can come back into the workforce if they want to.
So final question, and based on what you've been writing and researching, has this really been a transformational moment for employers and employees?
Absolutely. This has changed how we think about work on both sides of the equation. Employers have to think about how to keep people and keep them engaged, make them happy, and be able to continue to fill the corporate ladder pipeline. And for employees, they really have to think about what they want, and they have a lot of options. Consumer optimism is rising as we're coming out of the pandemic, and they're really in the driver's seat here.
The post-pandemic economy, the story available at Axios.com. Kim Hart joining us here in the D.C. area. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow was off by 97 points, the S&P breaking its three-day winning streak down by four, and the Nasdaq losing seven. Forbes magazine is reporting today that a new billionaire was minted every 17 hours over the past year, and the world's wealthiest are $5 trillion richer than a year ago. It was the 35th annual Forbes World's Billionaires list, and among those, Jeff Bezos, the richest person for the fourth year in a row at $177 billion. Elon Musk, now worth $151 billion, followed by Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and Warren Buffett, who is worth $96 billion. More details at Forbes.com. Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, is speaking out against executives with Major League Baseball, Coca-Cola, Delta Airlines, and other corporations for criticizing Republican-led efforts to impose restrictions on voting access in Georgia and other states. The Kentucky lawmaker is accusing them of, quote, bullying politicians. In remarks earlier today in Louisville, Senator McConnell had this warning to corporate America.
Well, look, let me just give an example. Let's take Major League Baseball, which is a pretty important corporation. If they applied the same standard they applied to Georgia, they couldn't have games in St. Louis because Missouri has a more restrictive voter law than Georgia, than the new Georgia law. What are they going to do about the Mets and the Yankees? New York has a more restrictive voter participation law than the new Georgia law. Where does it end? So my warning, if you will, to corporate America is to stay out of politics. It's not what you're designed for. And don't be intimidated by the left into taking up causes that put you right in the middle of one of America's greatest political debates. So that's my admonition. And Delta and the other Coca-Cola and the other companies that basically responded to this partisan appeal are doing the same thing. You know, Republicans drink Coca-Cola too. And we fly. And we like baseball.
That from Senator Mitch McConnell in his home state of Kentucky. Meanwhile, Brian Fallon, who is a former top aide to Senator Chuck Schumer, had this response, telling the New York Times, quote, "The earth is shifting under his feet. Senator McConnell is criticizing corporations for wading into political debates after years of defending their right to spend unlimited sums on political campaigns. This is a guy used to calling the shots, but he is suddenly powerless and flailing." That's from Brian Fallon, who now runs a Democratic group opposing Senator McConnell's judicial nominations. The full story available at nytimes.com. It is Governor Greg Abbott who announced that he would not throw out that ceremonial first pitch at the Texas Rangers home opener last night, where nearly 40,000 people attended. And the governor said that he would boycott any other Major League Baseball events, citing the league's decision, as you heard just a moment ago, to pull its All-Star game from Georgia. That game will now be played in Denver, Colorado. And on CNN earlier today, Texas Democratic Representative Sheila Jackson Lee was asked about possible changes to the laws in her state and about Governor Abbott.
Governor acted without facts, without substance, and obviously in a biased manner. I guess he does not understand all of the pain that the foot soldiers went through crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge to really fight for voting rights for everyone. Clearly, the bill that is proposed here in Texas is voter suppression. Clearly, the bill that was passed in Georgia is voter suppression. And all he's doing is trying to agitate as opposed to collaborate and to see how we can move forward, not as Republicans and Democrats, but as Americans who believe in the right to vote for everyone.
It seems to be that there is this attempt or race to say, you know, I'm the victim here. Greg Abbott saying that somehow he's the victim because baseball has moved the All-Star game out of Georgia. In your mind, in this discussion about voting rights, who is the victim?
Well, clearly it's all of those voters who, without an iota of fraud, voted in 2020 and look forward to voting in 2021 and 2022 and all the elections around America. It is clearly those who are the victims of the made-up stories that have caused 43 Republican legislatures across America to do things as inhumane as don't give them water or don't give them food, or debunking and eliminating the power of the Secretary of State in Georgia, or videotaping disabled persons in Texas trying to get assistance in voting, or being a poll watcher and intruding on a frail voter, an elderly voter, or a young voter, and intimidating them, or making sure that counties over a million, like Harris County, that is very diverse, and Dallas County, and San Antonio area, that you don't have control of your polling places. The victims are voters. And absolutely, we're not going to take it, John. Dr. King said, we're on the move. You're not going to turn us around. And we're on the move for voting justice in America. The federal government is going to have to pass these voting rights bills, including the John Robert Lewis bill, in order to say to America, your voting rights are not to be extinguished.
And we'll have more on H.R. 1 later in the program. Those comments earlier today on CNN with Texas Democratic lawmaker Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. You're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back. This is Washington Today for Tuesday, April the 6th, and here are some of your other headlines. Florida Congressman Elsie Hastings has passed away. He was 84 years old after battling cancer. You'll hear a portion of his first speech on the House floor back in 1993, just ahead. And in politics in California, former reality TV star Caitlyn Jenner talking with political consultants that she is actively considering a run for governor of California. And now to day seven in the murder trial of former Minneapolis Police Chief Derek Chauvin. Two police officers with experience in crisis intervention and the use of force speaking about proper procedures, with one of them saying that the now fired officer's knee on George Floyd's neck was not part of the department's training. Lieutenant Johnny Mercil oversees the use of force training. He was the eighth current or former Minneapolis police officer to testify, including the department's chief, who we heard from yesterday. At one point, Lieutenant Mercil was shown a photo from the viral bystander video of George Floyd under Derek Chauvin's knee and then was asked whether the tactic is part of the department's training that the officer used and would have received. Well, more from the courtroom with prosecutor Matthew Frank.
Sir, is this an MPD-trained neck restraint?
No, sir.
Has it ever been?
Not to my neck restraint? No, sir.
Is this an MPD-authorized restraint technique?
Knee on the neck would be something that does happen in use of force that isn't unauthorized.
And under what circumstances would that be authorized? How long can you do that?
I don't know if there's a time frame. It would depend on the circumstances of the time.
Which would include what?
The type of resistance you're getting from the subject that you're putting the knee on.
And so if there was, say, for example, the subject was under control and handcuffed, would this be authorized?
I would say no.
That from today's testimony in the case against former police officer Derek Chauvin. He is charged with second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter in the killing of George Floyd. By the way, three other fired police officers in Minneapolis who assisted in the arrest back in 2020, they are scheduled to be tried this summer in August on charges of aiding and abetting murder and manslaughter. In other news, a Navy sailor shot and wounded two people in Frederick, Maryland this morning before fleeing to nearby Fort Detrick, where he was killed by a police after breaching the gate there. All of this unfolding at about 8:30 this morning. Officials saying that the shooter was assigned to Fort Detrick but lived off the base. The victims were taken to a Baltimore area hospital, one in critical condition. The other is expected to be released tomorrow. And news on William Evans, the Capitol Hill police officer who was killed in that vehicle attack on Friday. Congress announcing today that he will lie in honor in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda. That will take place on April the 13th. Democrats on Capitol Hill are calling House Resolution 1 as the For the People Act. It is a comprehensive House bill on election laws that is now headed to the Senate for debate in that chamber. Supporters saying that the measure would streamline voter registration, requiring states to automatically register those eligible voters. Proponents say the bill would also change campaign finance laws, limit partisan gerrymandering, and focus on new ethical rules for people who hold federal office. Now, leading the opposition is South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. He says it would erode South Carolina's law requiring a photo ID to vote and describes the bill as a Democratic power grab. He was joined by Governor Henry McMaster, making his comments on his Senate's office Facebook page.
So I'm hopeful that Joe Manchin will look at H.R. 1 as destroying the ability of West Virginia to conduct an election as they see fit, following the laws of the land. The reason I'm here with Governor McMaster is to let every South Carolinian know why I'm so upset. If you can show me voter abuse where people are not allowed to vote fairly and freely, I want to fix that. I see a political effort to institutionalize voting at the federal level on terms most advantageous to the most radical people in the country. And I'm not going to be part of that, and I'm hoping Joe Manchin will not be. They're trying to change the filibuster for this. They're trying to convince Joe Manchin, just work with us on H.R. 1. Let's change the filibuster for one bill. Why are they picking this? This will destroy ballot integrity. This will institutionalize techniques used by the left to expand the vote in a fashion where there will be no integrity in the vote. This is the biggest power grab in modern American history, being pushed by the most radical people in modern American history to change the way we vote, to destroy the integrity of the ballot box. And we will not stand for it in South Carolina. And I am confident that Joe Manchin will be listening to the people of West Virginia.
And of course, Senator Joe Manchin, a key vote for Democrats. Those comments earlier today by Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. South Carolina Democrats do say the bill is needed after Georgia's move to put more voting restrictions in place. They argue the bill helps protect voting rights. And one of the key co-sponsors is longtime Congressman Jim Clyburn. He is calling the measure, in his words, quote, a voter empowerment act. Well, the Senate parliamentarian has ruled the Democrats may amend the budget resolution they used for their COVID-19 bill and attach another set of reconciliation instructors to the president's plan for infrastructure. The ruling is a key step as the Democrats weigh their options on moving on legislation with a price tag of more than $2 trillion. We will talk to a leading budget reporter from Roll Call and explain what it all means. But first, reaction from the White House with Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Jen, Senator Schumer's office said last night that the Senate parliamentarian had ruled in favor of additional reconciliation bills. I wondered if the administration have any view on that ruling. And in light of this ruling, is this the likely path that the president will take with the Senate in terms of getting this infrastructure bill across the finish line?
Well, the president continues to believe, less than a week after he announced the plan, I'll say, that there's a bipartisan path forward. And we are encouraged, not just by 80% of the public that believes that it is long overdue to invest in infrastructure, that not just roads, rails, and bridges, but there is a way we should, a role the federal government can play in rebuilding the infrastructure of our economy and helping support American workers for the 21st century. This is a mechanism, as you know, reconciliation is a mechanism for passing budgetary bills in Congress. We will leave the mechanisms and the determination of the mechanisms to leaders in Congress. But right now, less than a week after he announced the American Jobs Plan, our focus is on engaging with Democrats and Republicans, with staff, with committee staff, inviting members to the White House next week. And we are encouraged by some of the statements that have been made about components of the package where we could find agreement.
Those comments from White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. And joining us on the phone is Paul Krawczyk. He covers budget issues for CQ Roll Call. And I want to go back to the issue of the Senate parliamentarian and the ruling late yesterday. Why was that so significant?
Well, it was significant because Democrats in a 50-50 Senate and with a very narrow majority in the House are trying to pass a lot of legislation, big legislation. President Biden has proposed a big infrastructure plan, and he wants to follow that up with additional legislation targeting child care, health care, and things like that. And so obviously it's going to be very hard to pass this to get 60 votes in the Senate to pass this legislation. That's typically what you need. But if you use the budget reconciliation process, you can pass budget-related legislation in the Senate with just a simple majority, 51 votes. So Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer came up with the question, could we pass a revised 2021 budget resolution that would include reconciliation instructions so that we could perhaps pass infrastructure through the reconciliation process? And then later in the year, we could do a fiscal 2022 budget resolution with reconciliation instructions and use that to pass the rest of President Biden's proposals. Well, this has never been done before, but there is a section in the 1974 budget law that says you can do a revised budget resolution, a second revised budget resolution in the same fiscal year. And that's been done once. Back in 1977, they actually did adopt a revised budget resolution. But it did not include reconciliation instructions. So Schumer's question to the Senate parliamentarian, who is the top interpreter of budget law and budget precedent in the Senate, his question was, could we do a revised budget resolution that includes reconciliation instructions? And the parliamentarian said, you may do that.
And as you point out in your story, that involves Section 304 of the 1974 budget law. At some point, you reach the debt limit with all of this spending. How does this impact Congress's ability to raise the debt limit?
It probably does. Now, it's important to note that the parliamentarian's opinion was very, very cursory. and there are a lot of unanswered questions about how exactly this would work. And there are even some skeptics who aren't sure that this could be used to actually pass a revised budget resolution with reconciliation instructions this year. So there are a lot of unanswered questions, but the reconciliation process can be used to raise the debt limit. And the current debt limit suspension, the debt limit is suspended until August 1st. And after that, the debt limit will rise to the total amount of debt at that time. And after that, Congress will have to suspend the debt limit or raise the debt limit, and you can do that through reconciliation. So it's possible that if they do a revised budget resolution, they could use reconciliation to raise the debt limit.
We're talking with Paul Krawczyk of CQ Roll Call. Bottom line, for the moment, this puts the ball in the Democratic court, correct?
Correct. But again, there are a lot of unanswered questions, and Democrats are not even sure of all the details of how this process will work.
The headline at rollcall.com, second filibuster-proof maneuver, okayed by Senate parliamentarian. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Citing the coronavirus pandemic, North Korea becoming the first country to drop out of the Tokyo Olympics this summer, games already that have been delayed a full year due to COVID-19. And there is more Olympic news on the Winter Games next year. The State Department today confirming that it is considering a possible joint boycott of the 2022 Beijing Olympics. This as there has been a growing list of calls for the U.S. to back out of the event because of violations of human rights claims inside China. Some background, Senator Mitt Romney, he headed up the Winter Games in Salt Lake City nearly 20 years ago. He's already called for an economic and diplomatic boycott. And at the State Department today, these comments by spokesperson Ned Price.
Can you detail how the State Department has been or will be involved in the administration's decision on that front?
Well, part of our review of those Olympics and our thinking will involve close consultations with partners and allies around the world. We have consistently said when it comes to our concerns with the government in Beijing, including Beijing's egregious human rights violations, its conduct of genocide in the case of Xinjiang, that what the United States does is meaningful. What the United States does will have impact. But everything we do that brings along our allies and partners will have all the more influence with Beijing. And so that is why the Department of State, as part of our thinking on the Beijing Olympics, is engaging with partners, with allies, to coordinate closely on decisions and approaches to the government in Beijing. You saw an illustration of that only the other week when the United States, together with the United Kingdom, together with Canada, together with the EU, enacted a set of sanctions against those responsible for some of the atrocities in Xinjiang. So clearly, we are coordinating on all of these issues of concern. And of course, the Beijing Olympics is an area that we will continue to discuss.
And when do you think those discussions will, specifically on the Olympics, will be concluded with partners and allies?
Well, of course, this is we're talking about 2022, and we are still in April of 2021. So these games remain some time away. I wouldn't want to put a time frame on it, but these discussions are underway.
News today from the State Department, and that from its spokesperson, by the way. If it happens, it would be the first U.S. boycott of Olympic Games since Moscow, led by President Carter, pulling out of the Games in 1980. Congressman Elsie Hastings, a civil rights lawyer, he became Florida's first African-American federal judge, impeached on corruption charges, making a political comeback as a Democratic member of the House and also the dean of Florida's congressional delegation. He died today at the age of 84. He had been battling pancreatic cancer for years. It was on June 15, 1993, he made his first speech as a member of Congress. This from the C-SPAN Video Library.
Americans are the first to organize international relief efforts, collect food and clothing for victims of earthquakes, hurricanes, cyclones, and famines, hold concerts to raise money for various causes, and leave their jobs to go volunteer in hospitals, schools, and industries abroad. How many letters have each of us received from constituents expressing their outrage over the ongoing atrocity in the Balkans and demanding to know why the United States has not stopped it. How many phone calls have we gotten urging us to end famine in Africa and Asia and support newly independent democratic states? I'm not hearing that our constituents don't support foreign aid. I'm hearing that our constituents don't understand foreign aid and that some of us don't have the moral strength to educate them appropriately. Please don't confuse the mandate of the voters with our own ineptitude.
That from June 15th, 1993. In a statement today, Speaker Pelosi saying, quote, Congressman Hastings leaves behind a powerful legacy of activism and action on behalf of all Floridians and Americans. His leadership and friendship will be missed by his many friends in Congress. The Florida lawmaker representing Congress for 28 years, Congressman Elsie Hastings, died today. He was 84 years old. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. I'm Steve Scully for the Tuesday edition. Hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.